Case number 07-5392, Myra A. Hendricks, appellant versus Henry M. Paulson, Jr., Secretary of the Treasury. Mr. Ms. Bowie for the appellant, Mr. Birch for the appellee.
May it please the court, I'm Molly Bowie, and along with my co-counsel Robert Selden, we represent the appellant Myra Hendricks in this case. I have requested to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This appeal involves two significant legal errors committed by the district court in granting summary judgment to the government, both of which violate established employment law precedent by this circuit. First, the district court erred by holding that in order to prevail, or in order to survive summary judgment on her non-selection claims, plaintiff was required to prove that she was significantly or markedly better qualified than the successful applicants, in this case, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Rededick. Second, as to the Rededick selection, the district court erred by crediting the government's explanation that it did not consider plaintiff's application or her qualifications for the position because it filled the position through a lateral transfer of Mr. Rededick. Further, the lower court failed to recognize that the fact that defendant structured the selection in such a way as to eliminate competition by the appellant may itself be evidence of pretext.
You're referring to the second selection?
That's right, Your Honor, to the Rededick selection.
By choosing from the non-competitive list, you mean?
That's right.
But the scheme is set up so that the non-competitive list is there to be used.
That's right, Your Honor, but the selecting official, Mr. Jones, admitted that he could have selected from the competitive certification.
It's always true, isn't it?
Yes, that is correct, and he did so, in fact, in a previous selection when a non-competitive candidate was available, and he selected a white male candidate from the competitive list rather than laterally transferring the non-competitive candidate. It was only in this selection when Ms. Hendricks was on the competitive certificate and Mr. Rededick was on the non-competitive certificate that he limited his consideration of the applicants to the non-competitive certificate.
Is the universe for comparison here just these two instances, or is there a whole string of them?
Those are the two instances that plaintiff is aware of because the previous selection that I referred to, the McKeever selection, was one that plaintiff challenged below. She does not challenge it here.
Okay. All right, back to your other, the other vacancy.
Yes. Turning to that vacancy, well, the first error that was committed by the district court in terms of limiting its analysis to a qualifications comparison, that is applicable to both the Johnson selection, which is the first selection, and the Rededick selection. In so limiting her analysis, the district court ignored this court's decisions in ACCA versus Washington Hospital Center and in Holcomb versus Powell, where this circuit made clear that a plaintiff is not limited to comparing her qualifications against those of the successful applicant in order to demonstrate pretext in a non-selection claim. In fact, in the recent decision of Brady versus Office of the Sergeant at Arms, Judge Kavanaugh listed many ways in which a plaintiff may demonstrate pretext. Those include producing evidence of more favorable treatment of persons outside of a plaintiff's protected groups, pointing to an employer's failure to follow established procedures or criteria, and pointing to discriminatory statements or attitudes held by the decision maker. Each of those categories of evidence was present in both the Johnson selection and the Rededick selection in this case. However, that evidence was either completely ignored by the district court or it was disregarded improperly. As to the Johnson selection, plaintiff pointed to substantial evidence that the decision maker, the selecting official, Brian Dwyer, harbored discriminatory attitudes towards women. Plaintiff placed affidavits from two female agents on the record who recounted statements that Dwyer had made to them to the effect that women didn't belong in federal law enforcement, and that that it was only when the agency had hired women as agents that the male agents had to change their behavior.
That could be a good thing, couldn't it?
Well, it could be a good thing, except the context that Mr. Dwyer made that statement in was in dismissing the female agent's complaints about a male employee who was harassing her. If you look at the affidavit that was submitted by that woman, that was the context that Mr. Dwyer made the statement in. And certainly the statement that it was the downfall of the agency when it hired female employees, I can't find a way that statement could be interpreted positively. Ms. Hendricks also submitted affidavits and deposition testimony from two female managers who worked under Mr. Dwyer's supervision, one of whom was relied upon by the defendant. That was Jackie Colonna. She also presented evidence by Jean Keller, both of whom testified that Mr. Dwyer treated the female agents under his supervision disparately, that he favored male agents in giving job assignments, that he was more lenient towards them in terms of their productivity and meeting deadlines, and that he treated them more leniently in disciplinary matters.
If this case had gone to trial, would you then be producing, what evidence would you be producing along this line?
We would be calling the two women who submitted the affidavits about Mr. Dwyer's statements. We would be calling them to the stand. We would also be calling Ms. Keller and likely Ms. Colonna as well. So we would have direct testimony from each of those witnesses, all of whom were listed on plaintiff's initial disclosures.
And for the defendant's case, what would it be open for him to introduce?
I don't believe I understand your
question.
Well,
so what kind of proof could the defendant put in? What type of proof, not specifically, what type of proof could the defendant put in at that point?
To rebut those?
Yes, to rebuttal, I'm sorry.
Well, they could call Mr. Dwyer to the stand, who could say, I never did that and I never made those statements.
Well, putting aside the statements, whether he made the statements relate to historical facts about his conduct in the agency, don't they?
Yes, and it also relates to Mr. Dwyer's credibility. If you've got four women...
Would it be open to him to put in evidence about, what was one of the statements? You can give me an example again.
That it was the downfall of the agency when it hired female agents. Mm.
So would he be in a position to put in evidence that there had been no downfall, that the agency is just as functional as has ever been?
I suppose he could. I don't know that it would be relevant. The issue isn't the truth of his statement. The issue is that he made the statement, which is indicative
of... Whether he made the statement, I mean, if the statement would be fantastic and impossible, then presumably he could show that.
Well, I don't know that factually. I mean, maybe in Mr. Dwyer's mind, the downfall happened when he had to stop behaving like it was a locker room. Maybe that to him constitutes the downfall.
That was the good part, the good gloss, remember?
Okay, go ahead. Another facet of evidence that plaintiff introduced was that Mr. Johnson had no business being a law enforcement agent in the first place, and specifically that he certainly was not eligible or should not have been eligible to receive a promotion into SID, SIID, which was the agency's premier internal investigations unit. The agency selected Mr. Johnson, who had two egregious incidents of misconduct in his past, and who, in fact, had been investigated.
Well, that's
by
your characterization that they were egregious. They were rather lightly punished, weren't they?
Yes. Well, I think that
the
is also.
The agency didn't treat them as egregious.
No, which appellant also takes issue with, but that was...
That's not the question. In fact, it's not a question whether he should have been an agent or not. I mean, we're not sitting, and you've read the cases, we don't sit as a super employment board.
Yes, Your Honor,
or promotion board. We can think they're very wrong and still hold in their favor if there's not an inference of discrimination to be raised.
Correct, Your Honor, but appellant...
You're getting close to saying that we're a super employment board.
I'm certainly not saying that, Your Honor. However, I do believe that this court is perfectly capable of saying that that by defendant's own admission, by the admission of all of the managers who we deposed in this case, integrity is central to the mission of the agency. That is undisputed.
I understood it to be the defendant's position and maybe the agency's at the time that integrity wasn't at issue in these offenses.
Well, that is defendant's position, but I feel it is appellant's position that that's a matter of dispute. If you have an agent who has consistently, or at least in two significant cases, broken agency directives by getting drunk, getting into a fight, and losing his weapon.
Not every agency directive goes to integrity, isn't that fair?
No, certainly not. But the mission of the agency, by the admission...
Did he obfuscate or lie about the use violations?
He was... There's no evidence to suggest that Mr. Johnson himself brought these incidents to the attention of the agency.
Did he in any way try to dodge them?
Well, because the defendant lost or did not maintain any of the records from the disciplinary actions, we don't know what happened.
Fair enough. What about moral turpitude? Is that involved in either offense?
Certainly with respect to, well, Mr. Johnson had intercourse with a person who was not allowed to be in the government vehicle with him.
But the offense was having this person in the government vehicle.
Yes, that was the minimum offense. That
was the offense charged, right?
That was the offense. And it was also charged, it was part of the offense that was charged against Mr. Johnson was the sexual intercourse, as well as that he had a person who wasn't supposed to be in the car with him in the car.
And was he convicted, as it were, of that?
Yes, he received a 30-day suspension.
No. Of having somehow improper intercourse in the car, or was it the only having the ineligible person
well,
in the car? I had understood it was only having an ineligible person, but I may be mistaken.
Well, Your Honor, like I said, we don't have the disciplinary
records. That's
all
we know.
All we know is that 30 days is the minimum that a person receives as a sentence for having an impermissible person in the car. So we know at least that. I would also like to turn to the Rodetic selection, if I may. The district court essentially held that the operative fact in the Rodetic selection was that Ms. Hendricks's application was not considered. In fact, this court...
Not considered because she was on the competitive
list. On the competitive list, that's correct. But this court has made clear in Cones versus Shalala and in Latham versus Snow that a defendant may not escape liability from claims of discrimination or retaliation simply by refusing to allow a plaintiff to compete for a position. That is essentially what happened here. Ms. Hendricks was prevented from competing, even though they were fully aware of her credentials. They were fully aware that she had served as a technical support officer before, from the ranks of which every other assistant special agent in charge for this technical support division had been drawn previously. So every other time before,
instances are there?
Your Honor, I don't know that.
When you say
certain.
Every time, you must have looked at them, right?
Ms. Hendricks submitted an affidavit on summary judgment stating that every previous time this position had been filled, it had been filled by someone from those ranks. The selecting official, Mr. Jones, when I asked him about that in his deposition, did not dispute that. Nobody.
I'm just wondering, I mean, if it's one instance and no one disputes it, it's hardly probative. But if it's 30 instances, then it starts to look, or five, it starts to look different, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, I don't have a specific number. But I would say even if it had been one instance, it would be probative of the fact that they had selected someone who was a TSO previously, and then when Ms. Hendricks, who had been a TSO for 7 years, came up for consideration for the same position, they didn't even consider her application, didn't even look at it. They only lateraled in Mr. Rededick. Under Cohns versus Shalala,
is it the practice that if there's a qualified person on the non-competitive list, they should be taken?
The most qualified person should be taken.
Well, but if you don't get to the competitive list, you don't make that comparison except within the non-competitive group, right?
Right, but Your Honor, by limiting his consideration to the...
This is a government-wide or executive branch-wide scheme, is it not, where there's a competitive and a non-competitive?
That is my understanding,
okay.
Yes.
So is it the norm that if there is a fully qualified person on the non-competitive list, they should get the selection before one goes to a competitive list?
Your Honor, there has been no evidence to that effect presented by the defendant, and that is not what Mr. Jones testified to.
What is the difference in the effect of being on the competitive and the non-competitive list, then?
The difference is if you're on the non-competitive list, you may be lateraled into the position without competition. Mm-hmm. If you're on the competitive list, by nature, you have to compete for the position.
Right. So isn't that consistent with what Judge Ginsburg just asked you, that the normal preference practice would be that if there's a person non-competitive, they would get the job without looking into the competitive list?
Well, Your Honor, that was not the practice followed by Mr. Jones in a previous selection of Ronald McKeever. That's
well,
right.
About that previous selection, did he say, I went to the competitive list because there was no one qualified on the non-competitive
list? No, Mr. Jones did not say that. And there's been no evidence that it was the practice government-wide or specifically in TIGTA to always select from the non-competitive list when there are competitive candidates available. There's been no evidence to that effect.
In this case, do we know whether Jones was aware of Hendricks' application?
Yes, Mr. Jones stated that he was aware. I have the citation to that in the brief. He was fully aware of her qualifications and her application, but as far as his testimony goes, he just didn't consider it in this case.
He didn't consider the competitive list.
That is his testimony, correct.
Right. It wasn't that he didn't consider her. He didn't consider the competitive list.
That is his testimony, correct.
Are there other people on the competitive list?
Yes, there were other people on the list.
How many?
Your Honor, I can look it up. It's in the joint appendix.
Okay, but there was definitely other individuals.
Yes, there were more.
And on the non-competitive list from which he did select, was there more than one?
I believe that there may have been one other person on that list.
Now, Jones says that basically Doak recommended Rededick.
Rededick. Yes.
Okay. And and he accepted his recommendation. Do we know whether Doakes knew about Hendricks' application?
He certainly did know about her application, and he knew about her qualifications. In fact, when Ms. Hendricks had retired, so to speak, from being the technical support officer after 7 years, Mr. Doak had written her a letter, an email praising her service in that position. So he was well aware both of Ms. Hendricks' application and her qualifications.
Okay, and did he also know of her protected activity?
Yes, everyone involved in this case knew of it. Your Honor, I see that I meant to...
We'll give you a couple of minutes back for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Hear from the appellee.
May it please the court. Good morning, Alan Birch on behalf of the United States. Opposing counsel presents this case as though it were something other than a qualifications comparison case. That is contrary to how the case has been presented below and certainly to the vast majority of the evidence that Ms. Hendricks has presented. She's attacked the qualifications of the selectees. She's presented her own qualifications. If you were to eliminate the qualifications evidence and present this case on a different theory, there would be almost no evidence left at all, with the possible exception of the Me Too evidence. So it is appropriate to view this under the qualifications comparison case law. ACCA is certainly consistent with that. Certainly Combs and Lathrum also hinge on a comparison of the applications of the selectee and the plaintiff. And here, the district court did nothing to avoid that sort of comparison, but dived right in and made that comparison thoroughly and appropriately. And it is clear that the proper standard under that sort of a theory is that the plaintiff has to show that she is significantly better qualified. And here, if anything, the evidence shows exactly the opposite, that the selectees were, in both cases, significantly better qualified than the plaintiff. There was no error in that analysis. Turning to some of the comments from the other side, I would note that she did concede the difference between misconduct generally and integrity problems in particular. That's important in this case. That goes to the defendant's assessment of Mr. Johnson's misconduct.
Let's talk about that because
sure.
I'm not sure that I understand the integrity argument.
All right.
There's a suggestion, at least in this record, that when Mr. Johnson lost his weapon during this altercation, he did not notify the agency that had happened.
Right. The argument in the reply brief, which is a new spin on the evidence, it's only in the reply brief that we see that they have tried to spin this as an attack on his integrity, that he somehow concealed the incident. That's new to the reply. And the evidence is based on their tortured reading of his deposition in which he describes the event. Now, his description of the event is the only evidence of the event, and he describes the event as coming out of a restaurant where he had dinner and some alcohol to drink, and he came out with some others he had dinner with, including a couple of women. And while he was talking with one of the women, apparently one of the women's ex-boyfriend thought that the two of them were together and attacked him from behind. The police arrived very quickly and broke up the fight, and they recovered the weapon at that time. So there's not a time frame here that suggests that he was concealing anything. Certainly there's no evidence that he concealed anything from Treasury. In Treasury's view.
How did the Treasury get wind of the event?
The police department needed to return the weapon, and because they had taken
it.
They recovered it at the scene, and they were not going to give it back to Mr. Johnson at that time, so they contacted his employer and said.
Or is there some doubt about his entitlement to just be handed back the weapon?
Apparently, Your Honor, I'm not sure what the circumstances were. It could easily have been protocol to make sure that they got all the facts straight before they turned the weapon back over.
The arresting department contacted the Treasury.
Yes. I would assume that would be a regular course to make sure that he actually worked for the Treasury Department, that sort of thing. His credentials were valid. Presumably that would take place during business hours. There's nothing to suggest any concealment of this from the Treasury Department.
So you don't know if there's a requirement by the Treasury Department that if something happens to your weapon, you have to report it immediately or something like that?
Doesn't have anything like that, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about this second incident, which seems to have involved carrying an unauthorized passenger and sexual activity.
Right. The latter was put under seal, Your Honor. So I would direct your attention
to... It's already been unsealed this morning.
Yes, essentially. At the appendix at page 562, you'll see his description of what was sustained. The evidence is that the allegation that was sustained was only the unauthorized passengers in a government-owned vehicle.
So essentially, misuse of a government resource...
Exactly. My understanding is that the GOV refers to what I would visualize as an undercover police car, an unmarked car. It's not simply a rental car. It has equipment in it, that sort of thing. So it's an important matter to not be carrying passengers around in. Mm-hmm. That was the nature of the allegation. There are standards, apparently, that require a 30-day minimum suspension for that sort of violation, and that's what was imposed.
And it seems as if the argument here is, well, those things are, you know, misusing government resources or whatever is not an affirmative lie, so therefore it doesn't go to integrity. Is that...
That's my understanding of the thinking, Your Honor, and I believe it has to do with the Giglio concerns that attach to any law enforcement officer's career, that his career, his or her career, depends on this the agent's credibility as a witness. And so that's why the integrity in terms of concealing or altering evidence or not being truthful are so important. But because of the gravity of the impact that this can have on a law enforcement officer's career, it's important not to be cavalier about expanding that category of misconduct too broadly.
Let me ask you another question. Because,
sure.
Because one of the assertions here is that Dwyer inquired, and he was told that the fact that there had been some misconduct in an agent's past was not disqualifying.
That's right.
All right. But disqualifying could mean once you've paid your dues, you are absolutely absolved of that past misconduct and no one should ever speak of it again. Or it could mean that it's simply not disqualifying. In other words, it doesn't bar you from being considered, but it would still be relevant.
That's right.
Correct. And here it seems to me the misconduct disappeared entirely from consideration.
The record is silent on that, Your Honor. Incidents were several years in the past. The GOV vehicle was 5 years in the past at that point. Incident with the firearm was 9 years in the past at that point. And the plaintiff has put in the record evidence of similar misconduct involving the firearm, for example, I think it was. And that was treated similarly. Mr. Jones testified that he viewed it as a serious matter, but not disqualifying. And he promoted, I believe, Mr. McKeever, who had a very similar kind of discipline. There's nothing about that creates an inconsistency with the application in plaintiff's case. If anything, it shows that it's consistent. There's nothing about that would raise an inference of going beyond any established procedure or bending over backwards to favor anyone. I'd also point out that with respect to the competitive and non-competitive lists, the use of the non-competitive list doesn't mean that the selection is necessarily non-competitive. There can be more than one person on the non-competitive list.
The other instance in which the promoting authority went beyond the the non-competitive list, there was only one
Exactly right, Your Honor.
Yeah.
There was only one person on that list. And by going to the non-competitive list in that selection, the McKeever selection, you'll see on that non-competitive, or excuse me.
You're going backward.
Yeah, I got it backwards. By going to the competitive list in the McKeever selection, you will see several names, including plaintiffs. Mm-hmm. And so the use of the broader list.
They were doing what the plaintiff is saying they didn't do here. That is, they put her in the mix where
right.
Here they didn't put her in the mix.
Exactly. So it cannot be evidence of them systematically manipulating the process to avoid considering the plaintiff. It simply doesn't hold water. I'm happy to address the Me Too evidence if there are questions about it. Our position generally is that it's insubstantial, I'm happy to take questions about it. With respect to on the Rodetic selection, they offer Ms. Keller, Ms. Parker McGill, Ms. Anderson. Ms. Keller, it bears noting, was she's a white female. She doesn't have any comments that tie her treatment to her race. She doesn't say that she ever saw any discrimination of the plaintiff. She doesn't have anything to say about the other people involved in the selection process, Mr. Doak, for example. I'm mixing up the selections. Mr. Camus or Ms. De Bonaventura. And the statements that she makes are so generalized that it's hard to put a weight on them. It's simply a matter of office tribulations that really don't provide a tangible grist for a comparison. Ms. Parker McGill, it gets even weaker. She has hearsay testimony about that she heard about unfair assignments. She doesn't recall ever experiencing it herself, and she admits at her deposition on page 657 of the Joint Appendix that most of her information about it came from plaintiff herself. Finally, Ms. Anderson said that she heard Mr. Dwyer say it was bad to hire women, but Mr. Dwyer also testified that he would never say such a thing because his own wife is a federal agent.
That's a credibility determination.
It isn't, because it his wife being a federal agent is undisputed. I mean, it does limit the, I would think, how serious the comment could have been taken in terms of his own.
Yeah, and that sounds like a credibility argument, doesn't it, counsel? Yeah,
perhaps, Your Honor, yes.
Good one. I'm not saying it's okay. It just may not be the right stage for it.
Thank you, Your Honor. In any event, we would submit that under the court's well-established analysis in cases such as Holcomb, these sorts of comments are not weighty enough to support the jury verdict in her favor. If there are no other questions, we would ask that the finding of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Seeing none, there's no time left, but we'll extend 2 minutes for rebuttal.
First, I would like to address the government's assertion that this case was argued differently at the lower court and than it has been argued on appeal. That is absolutely incorrect. Appellant put forward all of the evidence of pretext that she has raised on appeal before the district court. The problem is the district court did not consider the great majority of it, which is why we are here in this appeal today. As to the misconduct issue and how that does or does not factor into the selection or should not have factored into the selection, the government's reliance on Giglio in this case is misplaced. Giglio says that the reliability of a given witness, particularly a witness put on by the government, is relevant and must be disclosed to the opposing side. In this case, Mr. Johnson's misconduct, having violated two important government policies, number one, not drinking while you're armed, number two, not transporting unauthorized persons in your car, his violation of those policies certainly would have an impact on his credibility as a witness.
You really think that transporting an unauthorized person would have an impact on credibility?
I think transporting an unauthorized person and then having sex with them in the government vehicle.
We don't know that he had sex with him in the government vehicle, do we?
Mr. Johnson did not dispute that he did, Your Honor. And that is one of, according to Mr. Johnson's own admission, that was an element.
As I read the transcript, and maybe I missed part of it, he was asked what allegations were sustained against him, and the only allegation sustained was transporting the person. Is that not correct?
No, Your Honor, I believe Mr. Johnson said that having sexual intercourse in the GOV was an aspect of the allegation that was sustained.
Allegation. Yeah, allegation.
And that was
not sustained against him, was it?
Your Honor, I believe that it was.
Where in the appendix would I find that?
It should be in Mr. Johnson's deposition transcript, which I've inserted the applicable portions in the record there.
Similarly, with respect to the other dereliction on his part, I had thought it was losing possession of his weapon, not carrying it while drinking, that was the offense.
Your Honor, it was that he lost the weapon and that he was carrying the gun while he was drinking. That was an aspect of the discipline in that case.
And was that sustained?
Yes. He received I believe he received verbal counseling for that.
For that being for the drinking while carrying the weapon?
Yes, and losing the government weapon.
You see verbal counseling as part of the sentence, as it were, or the punishment?
That was his discipline, was a verbal counseling. And in fact, when I deposed Mr. Jones, I asked him about the policy against drinking while carrying your firearm, and he admitted that it was an important policy and that the purpose of that policy was to protect both the public and the agents themselves, Your Honor. So the government has acknowledged that that is an important policy and that it was prohibited. Your Honor, additionally, in terms of the misconduct, defendant's reliance on the Giglio and the nature of Mr. Johnson's misconduct is all belied by the fact that Mr. Dwyer himself transferred Jean Keller out of SID when she accessed an open email on her coworker's computer. He found that misconduct significant enough to transfer a female agent out of SID.
This conduct was significant enough to put the guy in the bricks for 30 days. I don't see where you're getting to say that she got a penalty for doing something wrong. He got a penalty for doing something wrong. 10 years from now, maybe she can get back in SID. That you don't have any. They're not even parallel. They're hardly tangential. That she got penalized. He got penalized worse for what he did.
Your Honor, actually being removed as an agent in SID and sent to an operations division that doesn't do investigations. To many law enforcement agents would be more severe.
30 days on the bricks is pretty serious to anybody that lives on a paycheck, counsel.
Well, his misconduct was pretty serious.
Yeah, right. But he got penalized for his misconduct. She got penalized for hers.
But he got promoted into SID. She got transferred.
Yeah, 10 years later.
No, 5 years
later. Okay, 5 years
later. And Ron McKeever got promoted into SID while he was serving his suspension for misconduct. Additionally, Your Honor.
You're over the time allotted unless my colleagues have further questions. Case is submitted.
Thank you.